Welcome to another Fanhouse MMA podcast. This is Michael David Smith, and I'm joined, as always, by Ariel Helwani. Ariel, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, MDS. How are you?
I'm doing just great. It was an interesting Memorial Day weekend. It was a great Memorial Day weekend if you're an MMA fan. And it actually stretched into Tuesday morning with Dream 9, which we'll get to in a bit. But I think we have to start with UFC 98. And Ariel, what were your thoughts? I know you were there in attendance at the MGM Grand. What did you think?
I love the show. I thought actually top to bottom, except for the controversy surrounding the Philippe Nover Kyle Bradley fight, I thought it was a great show, a lot of fun. And being in attendance for the Matt Hughes fight, and when Sarah came out to the Rocky theme song, that's one of the highlights of my young MMA reporting career. I really got goosebumps in that fight, and Sarah's demeanor, slapping people's hands, smiling, it was just a really fun scene to be a part of. And contrary to what some other people said, I thought it was actually a great fight. Perhaps it was a little different on television, but I really enjoyed that. And then, of course, the beginning of the Lyoto Machida era, I really don't see, and we could talk about this in a bit, I really don't see anyone beating this guy in the foreseeable future. That was one of the most impressive performances I've ever seen. That first round was nothing short of brilliant, I thought. Just the way he, you know, just picked his spots, waited for the right time, and then culminating with the attack that he, you know, just put on Rashad Evans and totally annihilated him, and that knockout was quite shocking to see in person. So overall, you know, night and day from UFC 97, and a lot of excitement and a lot of things to look forward to coming out of the show for the UFC.
Yeah, and I think the real story has to be Lyoto Machida. I agree with you. The Lyoto Machida era is going to last a long time, I think. I put together a list of guys who I thought maybe possibly could beat him. I really like the way Machida matches up against Rampage Jackson, who we all believe is going to get the first title shot at the end of the year, probably in the UFC's last show of the year. I really would pick Lyoto Machida to win that. I'd be very surprised if Lyoto Machida doesn't beat Rampage Jackson. So to me, the Lyoto Machida era, after he beats Rampage, if he does, I think it could extend a while. I would pick Lyoto against any of the 205-pounders in the UFC. I'd pick him over Forrest Griffin. I think if I had to pick one guy who would beat him, it'd probably be Shogun Hua, but I would pick him to beat Shogun. There are young up-and-comers. Maybe someday John Jones will be the type of fighter who could beat a Lyoto Machida, but certainly not yet. It's exciting to think what this guy can do. And I thought it was great to hear the fan response. You were there in attendance, and I want to get your reading on this. But both from myself watching on TV and hearing the fans, and also things like emails I've gotten from fans, comments that fans have posted at FanHouse, it's clear to me that this fighter, who was once derided as boring and the kind of guy who made fans want to turn off the TV, no one can say that anymore. Fans like this guy.
Oh, fans love him. I was actually really surprised at the reception that he got at the weigh-ins and, of course, on Saturday night. There were a lot more Machida fans at the MGM on Saturday night than there were Rashad Evans fans. As a matter of fact, Rashad Evans received a lot of boos, which I think is very interesting. I always viewed Rashad Evans as a fan favorite. I know that, you know, some people don't like his antics, but on the whole, he's such a likable character. So I was very surprised about that. And plus, he was facing a guy who a lot of people said was boring. So then I thought for sure Rashad would be the fan favorite. And on top of that, he was the champion. So a lot of factors in his favor. But Machida came out to a huge ovation. And then when he won, he got an even bigger ovation. And then in his post-fight interview, when he was like doing that inspirational stuff about, you know, if you dream something, you can make it happen, and karate and all this, I think then if you weren't a Lyoto Machida fan at that point, then you were officially one, because that was a great, great post-fight interview. I mean, the guy, you know, he's working on his English. He cares about, you know, trying to make new fans. He cares about being a crossover star in terms of, you know, with his Brazilian fans and his North American fans. And it was just a very it was just a very sweet moment to see a guy like that finally reach the mountaintop, so to speak. And even I don't know if the cameras caught this, but after he knocked out Rashad, I'm sure they weren't on Rashad, you know, laying there unconscious, but he just like fell to the ground and had his head on the mat, and it just seemed like he was overwhelmed with joy. One interesting thing about this past weekend that I wanted to mention about Machida, this guy, he's very humble. There was maybe like three times where I walked through the lobby of the MGM, and in the lobby, if you've ever been there, there are these huge, during a UFC fight week, they have these huge murals of the main event fighters. So this past week they had Hughes, Sarah, Machida, and Evans. And there were three different times that I walked by Machida's where he was there with his family and friends and fans taking photos, and he was so happy to be standing next to his mural. It was such a cool sight, because he just seemed so excited to be in this position and to be in the main event. And it's really interesting to think about, you know, if Frank Mir never got injured, Machida wouldn't have been in that main event, he wouldn't have received a title shot, and he wouldn't have been champion. So it's crazy to see how things turned out, but good for him, happy for the guy, and once again, I don't see anyone beating him anytime soon. No one in the current crop of light heavyweights, at least right now, I just don't see it happening.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned just the way he conducts himself. It's funny, a year ago, I was at UFC 84, also Memorial Day weekend, also MGM Grand, and I too saw Lyoto Machida outside the octagon a couple days before the fights, and he was the same way then. You know, he went out of his way to pose for pictures anytime a fan asked, sign an autograph anytime a fan asked. His English has improved a lot in the past year. His English was not very good a year ago, but he went out of his way to make sure he had someone with him who could translate if a fan wanted to say something to him. I went up and did a real quick interview just because I happened to see him and hadn't interviewed him before. So I went up and talked to him. He was very nice and giving with his time with me and pulled his translator over to make sure he understood all my questions and could answer them all. He's a nice guy. He's a likable guy. It is great that he's the champion. He's the best light heavyweight. The truth is, if it had been Rampage Jackson against Rashad Evans, that would have been a great fight too, but it would have been a fight that didn't have the best light heavyweight, because the best light heavyweight is the guy with the belt right now. That's Lyoto Machida.
Yeah, and when Rashad Evans first said that, by the way, I always mean to say this in the podcast at the beginning, I have horrible allergies and I always feel like I sound very nasal, so I apologize for anyone who thinks that I'm squeezing my nose while I'm talking here. But
yes, apology accepted.
Thank you. Rashad Evans said that he thought Machida deserved the title shot before Rampage. And at first when I heard that, I was kind of scratching my head. I was like, really? You know, Rampage, former light heavyweight champion, a guy who I thought didn't deserve to lose to Forrest Griffin, looked very good against Wanderlei Silva at UFC 92. I kind of scratched my head about that one. But now I see exactly what he was talking about, because Rashad Evans, Rampage Jackson, Rashad has a great chance to win that fight. Now you see, after what happened on Saturday night, Rashad is nowhere near the level of a Lyoto Machida. I mean, there were actually some people who were picking Rashad Evans, and, you know, God bless them. They must have saw something that we all didn't know about, and clearly, you know, we were kind of right, the ones that did pick
Machida. Lyoto Machida didn't know about it either,
Exactly. And he was just really confident, and even in the media workouts, you know, like the guy was all business, but at the same time, just so relaxed, you know, like I just watched him doing his, the sparring session in front of the media, and he really didn't do anything. Actually, he probably did the least of the guys who were there. Matt Hughes never even showed up, but he was just seemed so relaxed and it's just so confident, and that's a scary thing when you have a fighter that is so relaxed and so confident going into a title fight where he's the contender. I just don't see anyone being able to figure this guy out. Like, if he's not going to get, you know, if he's not going to get nervous for a fight like that, now that he's a champion, I don't see him getting nervous. And right now, if someone would put me on the spot and say, who are the two guys that you think, or one guy who you think that can beat Machida, I would say one, Anderson Silva has a great shot at doing so. That fight is never going to happen. They're friends. You know, they have the same manager, etc., etc. As far as it's not going to happen. The other guy, and I know this is, sounds like a bit of a cop out, but that would be Fyodor Emelianenko. You know, top pound for pound fighter in the world, but a guy who fights at heavyweight, who really could be fighting at light heavyweight if he probably, you know, had a little bit better training regimen. He probably would rather fight at heavyweight because there are worse heavyweights out there than light heavyweights, but I think that he would be the guy with his striking and his ground game. That's the one thing we haven't seen Machida get tested on, is his ground game in the UFC. Fyodor would pose a lot of problems for Machida. So that those would be the two guys, and you know, on top of that, those fights aren't happening anytime soon. So that's why I'm so confident that for at least the next year or so, I think we'll see Lyoto Machida have that light heavyweight title belt in the UFC.
Yeah, and I hope you saw my list. I did, in fact, rank Fedor and Anderson Silva 1 and 2 among the people who could beat Machida, and I think you're absolutely right. The only person I would really pick to beat Machida at 205 pounds is Fedor Emelianenko. I actually would not pick Anderson Silva when and if the day were to come that they were to fight at 205 pounds. I personally would pick Machida. But Fedor, I would, you know, if Fedor, not that this is ever going to happen, but just because it's fun to speculate, if Fedor were to agree to step into the octagon, cut down to 205 and fight Machida, I would still pick Fedor to win that fight. But anyone else, I would pick Machida. There's no one I would pick, certainly in the UFC light heavyweight division, and no other promotion has any light heavyweights to speak of, who I would give much of a chance against Machida. I think it's really exciting to think about as Machida continues to hone his craft, and we're seeing him more aggressive, finishing more fights. I just think it's fun to think about how many good fighters they could throw at him. You know, he could be a guy who you look at and you know, he's beaten. A year from now or 2 years from now, we might be talking about how he beat Rampage Jackson and he beat Shogun Hua and he beat Forrest Griffin. I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. He hasn't done it yet. But I really think it's possible that he could beat all those guys in succession. And that would just be so incredibly exciting to see that.
Yeah, and by the way, what do you think of my pronunciation of Fyodor? It's pretty good,
right? It's good. Are you practicing because you're going to be meeting Fyodor and you want to say it the way he says it?
I always tell myself I need to start, you know, getting into that habit of calling him Fyodor. And yes, you're all right. I see Josh Barnett pulling it off so easily, so I figured that I should try doing it myself. But more to your point on, you know, what Machida could do in the future, you're absolutely right. I mean, let's not discredit what some of the other contenders at 205 have done and can do in the UFC. Shogun, Rampage, definitely no scrubs there. And, you know, in MMA, as we've seen so many times before, anything can happen. We even saw that this morning in Dream. So, all that said, Machida's style is just so unique. And when he attacks so precisely and so, and in such a vicious manner that, you know, like between that knockout on Saturday, the Thiago Silva knockout, I mean, this guy is deadly. I mean,
I don't want to interrupt, but I want to throw in the Sokaju submission, because I think the way he saw that opportunity on the ground in his fight against Sokaju was a very impressive submission. I think there are a lot of guys who would have been in that position that Machida was in against Sokaju and wouldn't have. It's like he just pounces instantly. I think there are a lot of guys who wouldn't have immediately seen that opening and choke out their opponent the way Machida did to Sokaju. And you are so right. That's what he does. It's not that he's not aggressive. It's not that he's not an attacker. It's just that he waits until just the right moment. And we see it over and over again. When that moment comes, he nails it.
Yeah, and when I said that he hadn't been tested on the ground, I meant, you know, because Sokaju is not exactly top Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
No, you are correct about that.
But that's why I think Shogun or Anderson Silva could do a pretty good job of testing him on the ground and would pose some interesting problems for him. I don't really see Rampage doing that. I see the thing about Rampage is he likes to stand and trade, and Rashad Evans tried to stand and trade with him. I thought Rashad Evans should have tried to take Machida down. And obviously we know that Evans jiu-jitsu is not at the level of Machida's, but I thought that he would have been able to perhaps ground and pound him, take him down, try to out-muscle him. You know, he's a very great wrestler, very strong guy. I thought that would have been his game plan. I was surprised to see him stand there and try to trade with Machida, because we've seen Machida be so effective on his feet. So, you know, I don't think Rashad has anything to be ashamed about. It's unfortunate that his title reign only lasted one fight. And, you know, it's interesting because the light heavyweight division in the UFC is the glamour division. It's sort of like the heavyweight division in boxing. And now we've seen from last year, UFC 86, Rampage loses the title. Then Forrest loses the title at UFC 92. Now Rashad Evans loses the title at UFC 98. We've seen now four different champions in less than a year. So it's going to be interesting to see if this division can sort of, you know, level out here, and we'll see a dominant champion like we've seen at 185 in the UFC, because that's really what I expect. But wouldn't be shocked to see something else happen. But if I'd have to put money on it, I think that Lyoto Machida will now hold this title perhaps even longer. And I know this sounds crazy, and I'm not trying to jump on the bandwagon, you know, a couple of days after, but perhaps even longer than Anderson Silva. I just think that he is really, really that damn good. And maybe the only reason why Anderson Silva will hold the record longer is because there's less competition at 185. But I think right now, Machida, Anderson Silva, you can make a case for them being 3A, 3B in terms of the top pound-for-pound fighters in the world. I think that highly of Machida right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could make the case even higher than that. I think you could make the case that Machida goes above George St. Pierre and behind only Fedor, because I just think if you look at the way Machida is dominating without getting beaten, I don't think there's anyone who compares to that except Fedor. I mean, even GSP does have a loss, a recent loss, and then longer ago he has the loss to Matt Hughes, but GSP still has a fairly recent loss to Matt Serra. To me, I think you can make a pretty good case. We've reached a point, in my opinion, in the UFC where GSP, Silva, and Machida are the three top pound-for-pound fighters, and it's hard to pick one over the other two.
Well, I don't want to go off the topic of Machida if you still have more to talk about, but I'm interested in talking a little bit about Matt Serra since you brought him up. What's your take on Matt Serra? Like, what's his legacy going to be now? Is he just going to be the one-hit wonder guy, or is he going to be, you know, a former champion who, you know, was able to defeat George St. Pierre and gave Matt Hughes a run for his money? I actually had him winning that bout, and I wouldn't have been disappointed with it being a draw, even though I hate draws. I just think that he hung with Hughes. He had a shot of beating him. And I'm curious to think, you know, at the end of the day, when Serra hangs it up, what's his legacy going to be? Is he just going to be that guy that shocked the world one time and then, you know, came back to earth? Or are people going to respect him? Because his record isn't that great. But, you know, his last few fights, except for maybe the UFC 83 performance, which was not that solid, definitely been impressive in my mind.
I think very impressive. I think his legacy will be that of a very good welterweight fighter beating George St. Pierre. You know, I think we might look back someday on GSP and look at his body of work and say anyone who ever beat him was doing something really great. And the two guys we saw in the octagon Saturday night are the only people who have beaten George St. Pierre. I think Matt Serra will go down as having been an excellent fighter. I think that I personally gave Hughes the second and third round, so I did give a close fight to Hughes. I wouldn't have argued if the judges had given it to Serra. I know you gave it to Matt Serra. I know our colleague Mike Chiappetta gave it to Matt Serra as well, so a lot of people went with Serra. I personally went with Hughes, as did the three judges. But no, Serra has accomplished a lot in this sport. Beating GSP, very big fight against Matt Hughes, winning the Ultimate Fighter, the comeback season, which was a season where the quality of the opposition in the Ultimate Fighter was a little higher than it has been in other seasons. All of that, I think, adds up to a good legacy. But the one other thing I want to say is that his legacy is not just going to be defined by what he accomplishes in the octagon, because he has already started working as a coach, and I think he's going to get more and more into coaching. We already see him sometimes in fighters' corners at UFC events and at other MMA events. And I think we're going to see more of that. And I think Matt Serra, he has the personality and the knowledge to be an excellent coach for a long time. And I think that could be the next phase of his career in MMA.
So do you think that he's done?
I don't know that he's done. I think we probably will see him in the octagon again, but I think he's at peace with what he's done in the UFC. I think he kind of understands that if he was ever going to get another shot at the title, he had to beat Hughes, and he didn't do that, so he's not going to get another title shot. I think we probably will see him fight again, but I think we'll see him coach more. He's got his schools. He's got the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu academies. He's doing a lot of MMA coaching, and I think that is what we're going to see from him most of all in the coming years.
Yeah, and I think MMA is a better place with Matt Serra around. Like just this past week in Las Vegas at the media day stuff, he was in such a good mood and always cracking jokes. This guy, and he's like, he's actually really funny, and you get the sense that it's not a shtick. He just seems like a great guy to be around, and it's fun to cover people like that. On the flip side, Matt Hughes, now this presents like some interesting issues because Hughes is definitely not getting a title shot anytime soon. You could actually have made a case that if Serra won on Saturday, he would be the next guy to get a crack at GSP and make this a trilogy, because after all, I mean, the guy did beat him once. He lost the title, and you could make a case for it, especially because there is no clear-cut contender at 170. And it's funny how, you know, a year ago or so, there were a bunch of them, and now it's a little gray right now at 170. You got guys like Mike Swick, obviously Thiago Alves is fighting for the title. I don't think John Fitch is gonna get a title shot anytime soon, just because he just got one in August. So you could have made a very good case for Serra getting another title shot, but Hughes has lost to GSP already twice. You know, he lost to Thiago Alves, so even if Alves wins.
Well, yeah, but I actually think you could make a case.
I mean, you could say that, okay, Thiago Alves came in overweight, and, you know, Hughes is a legend, blah, blah, blah. He deserves another shot, but I don't really want to see that fight again. So now I'm curious to see what happens with Hughes. If I were Joe Silva, I would probably book Josh Koscheck versus Matt Hughes. Koscheck is coming off of a loss, but still was, you know, doing very well before that. It was kind of a, you know, a freak knockout, and Koscheck has spoke many times in the past about how much he doesn't like Matt Hughes, so I think we could have some good trash talking there. Other than that, I don't really see where Hughes or Serra fit in, because I don't really see who Serra fights also. So they had this great fight. It was so exciting. To me, it was just as exciting as Evans and Machida going into the fight. But now I really have a hard time thinking about who they're going to fight next.
I'm not so sure that Matt Hughes doesn't deserve another title shot. To me, if Matt Hughes, say, wins another fight against a top 10 opponent, and if Thiago Alves, and this is the key, if Thiago Alves beats Georges St-Pierre, then I think you could see some people saying, well, wait a minute, let's give Matt Hughes a chance with Thiago Alves actually having to cut all the way down to 170, because to me, it is never that fight has never sat right with me, frankly. I never liked the way that fight went. I didn't like how Alves didn't make weight and then looked like the bigger and stronger guy and knocked out Hughes. I didn't like the fact that he got the knockout of the night award, for whatever that's worth, after that fight. To me, if you don't make weight, you shouldn't get an award. But I could see Hughes, and I could have seen Serra. I think the winner of Hughes-Serra, and it turned out to be Hughes, is kind of close to a title shot. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but especially if Alves beats Georges St-Pierre, I could see Matt Hughes getting that chance.
Okay, I could buy that. I mean, if you build up the fact that Alves missed weight and Hughes was a little banged up going into the fight, I don't know. I'm just kind of tired of seeing Hughes fight for the title. You know, I think that he's gotten plenty of shots. He's sort of dominated the division for a while. He lost the interim title fight, and now, like, you know, a year and a half later, well, actually, it'd probably be more than a year and a half later by the time they would fight. You know, if he gets another shot, I don't know. It just doesn't excite me as much. But then on the flip side, I don't really have a top contender in mind, because I don't believe that if Mike Swick defeats Ben Saunders, that he should get the title shot. And I've heard, you know, some talk of that. I don't know how you feel, but I just don't think that Swick has, you know, hasn't been at 170 for a while. You know, he's had some impressive victories, but not over, you know, top 10 opponents. And I just don't consider Ben Saunders a top 10 opponent right now.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, to me, if GSP beats Alves, then GSP has pretty well cleared the field in the welterweight division, which is extremely impressive, by the way, considering how many good welterweights there are in the UFC. But yeah, that would be around the point that we might start talking about should GSP's next move maybe be to move up to 185 and try to do to Anderson Silva what BJ Penn was not able to do to George St. Pierre. That to me might be the next one if GSP beats Alves. If GSP doesn't beat Alves, of course, then everything is up in the air. There are a lot of guys who would be in line to get a title shot against Thiago Alves, and that would throw a monkey wrench into everything. But I do tend to agree with you about the welterweight picture. It is pretty clear that these two guys who are fighting for this title are kind of far ahead of everybody else, and especially if GSP wins, there's not a lot left for him to prove against any of those guys below them. The one other, speaking of where people fit into the title shot, the other big fight to me, the big result, the result that really makes a difference in the UFC is that Frank Edgar didn't just beat Sean Sherk, but really dominated him 30-27 on all three judges' cards. I actually, the last time I did top 10 lightweights, had Sean Sherk at number two behind only BJ Penn. Clearly, he's not the number two lightweight. Frank Edgar beat him badly. Where do you think all these guys now fit into the lightweight picture in the UFC?
Yeah, the lightweight division is so exciting right now because unlike, you know, the welterweights and even to a degree the light heavyweights, there aren't that many rising stars and guys that I want to see eventually fight for the title. But right now, like off the top of my head, obviously Florian's getting the shot, Frankie Edgar, Gray Maynard, love to see those guys. Then you got Diego Sanchez, Clay Guida fighting. You know, who knows about, you know, if Nate Diaz can rebound. So there's a lot of interesting characters at 155 right now. And like you said, a very, very impressive performance by Frankie Edgar. This was a career-defining performance. I mean, Sean Sherk, only going into this fight, only had three losses on his resume. One of them was at 155, the other two at 170. The 155 bout was against BJ Penn last year at UFC 84, the event you attended. And then there was also losses to GSP and Matt Hughes. So, I mean, this guy is now Frankie Edgar putting himself in very good company. And the way he dominated Sean Sherk, after Sherk looked so good in defeating Tyson Griffin at UFC 90 in Chicago, that was really impressive stuff. And on top of that, we'd never seen Edgar box like that before. Very surprised that Sherk didn't try to take him to the ground and out-muscle him, especially because he's a big, strong wrestler. And even though Edgar is a wrestler himself, I just viewed Sherk as a stronger fighter. But all that said, this was extremely dominant, and it's an unfortunate situation because now Sean Sherk is really never fighting for the title. Like, he has, what does he have to shoot for? I mean, he just lost to Frankie Edgar. He lost the title bout to BJ Penn at UFC 84. He did beat Kenny Florian, so if Florian would have won, he could have made a great case for himself to be the next guy in line. But now, after this loss, he's sort of lost in the shuffle. On the flip side, Edgar lost to Gray Maynard last April. If he would have beat Maynard, he probably could have been the number one contender. So now we kind of have to see what happens with Sanchez and Guida in June. If Sanchez wins, you could probably make a good case for him being the number one contender or have him fight Frankie Edgar. And then, of course, Gray Maynard told me this past week at Extreme Couture that he's hoping to get back into action come September. So it's a very interesting time at 170 because a lot of these guys have fought each other. Some of them have defeated the other guy, but the other guy is on a bit of a more impressive winning streak, like Edgar and Maynard. So it's a very interesting time right now. But right now for Sean Sherk, I brought up the question to him before this fight: would he ever consider going up to 170? Just because it seems as though right now, you know, he's not getting that title shot again if he fights BJ Penn. He says he thinks he's too small for 170. And of course, you know, he lost to GSP, but I think, you know, I don't know if Thiago Alves wins, is that an option for him to go up to 170 and to try to make a run for the title there? Because what's the point if you can't get a title shot?
Yeah, well, I don't think he is going to get a title shot in either division. I think 170, there might be some interesting matchups, maybe with the two guys we were just talking about, if they want to do sort of an old-timers fight, Hughes or Sarah against Shirk at 170. But no, I don't think Shirk is going to be in the title picture in either division. I think Edgar kind of exposed the right game plan, and I think it's something that other fighters are going to emulate. I think Shirk thinks his stand-up is better than it really is. And overall, I think we saw the last time we're going to be talking about Sean Shirk as possibly in title contention. Whether he decides to stay at 155 or go to 170, I think now it's going to be more about just getting into some interesting matchups. But I don't think it's going to be about title contention. I don't think that's where Shirk is at this point in his career anymore.
Yeah, and neither do I. And it, definitely a great run for Sean Shirk. I don't think he should retire anytime soon. But I'm always interested to see what a fighter can do with his career when he's not in title contention and he's just not going to get that title shot anytime soon. It's kind of like, you know, Rich Franklin, you know what I mean? Like, the guy just had nothing going on at 185 after losing twice to Anderson Silva, now moving up, and is involved in an interesting fight come UFC 99. So there's still, you know, interesting fights out there for these fighters, but definitely no title shot coming anytime soon. Other very impressive performances at UFC 98, Krzysztof Szyszynski looking very impressive. Andre Guzmão now has two losses in the UFC after coming into the UFC undefeated. And Szyszynski was like sort of this journeyman fighter who made his way to the Ultimate Fighter show last season and now has, you know, developed into one of the most impressive guys coming out of that show, you know, with the Kimura victories. Now coming a month after his last victory at UFC 97, coming here to UFC 98 and knocking Andre Guzmão out. I know he was very disappointed that he didn't win the knockout of the night. And I think understandably so, just because of, you know, what Machida was able to do. But he's now an interesting character at the 205-pound division. And like I said, overall, this card was decimated with injuries, but it definitely produced lots of great finishes, lots of exciting fights. And, you know, one more time, the only black eye is, in my opinion, another strike for Yves Levine and another reason to really try to get Big John McCarthy back in the UFC. Yves Levine definitely blew it with the Philippe Novak-Kyle Bradley fight. He seemed unsure of himself. He stops the fight, then doesn't really stop the fight, lets it go on a few more seconds. Novak is clearly not injured, clearly not out of it, and it just makes everything look bad. I don't know if the UFC is putting pressure on him and that's making him second-guess himself, but as a referee, you can't do so. And on top of that, it just makes me feel like we need Big John in the octagon right now because there are so few good referees out there. It's crazy that he's not one of them calling these UFC fights.
Yeah, we do need Big John back. It's long past time. There are certain people out there who will try to tell you that the UFC has nothing to do with the fact that Big John's not in the octagon and that it's just up to the commissions, but that's not true. The UFC and Big John don't necessarily see eye to eye, and that I'm not going to say that that's the fault of either side, but the UFC does have enough pull to say these are the referees we think are good for our show, and these are the referees we think aren't good for our show. And as it stands right now, Big John isn't refereeing in the UFC, and that's disappointing because Big John is very good at what he does. And he needs to be back in there. I actually, you told me about the Philippe Novak Kyle Bradley stoppage and that you thought it was a terrible stoppage. I hadn't seen it at the time. I was, thanks to the magic of UFC.com, able to see it the next day. And I agreed with you, although there was one replay that was kind of, I think the replay that showed it from Yves Levine's angle, it was kind of a camera angle right behind Yves Levine, so you're sort of seeing what he's seeing. You could see how Philippe looked like he quickly collapsed as if he had been knocked cold, but then he immediately got back up, had his faculties, was trying to defend himself. But having said all that, whether that was a good stoppage or a bad one, I actually thought he did a terrible job when Drew McFedries knocked Professor X silly, just seconds into their fight, Eve Levine looked extremely tentative in trying to decide. He ended up stopping it at about 37 seconds of round one. I actually thought he looked like he wanted to stop it at about 20 seconds of round one, and then like he pulled back and he was thinking to himself, boy, if I stop it right here, am I going to get criticized for a fast stoppage? That is the worst attitude for a referee to have. And, you know, he was getting booed every time he was introduced at UFC 98. And it's worrisome that Eve Levine, it seems like it's gotten into his head.
Yeah, and he was actually one of the, you know, better referees out there. But, you know, with that Nova-Bradley fight, I know that Nova kind of fell down for a second, and I actually thought he was out as well. Great punch by Bradley. But the thing that bothered me so much about it is that he was so tentative that he sort of stopped it but didn't stop it, and that's the same thing that happened in the Pete Sell fight at UFC 96 against Matt Brown. And as a referee, you just can't do that, because if you kind of half-stop the fight, something else can happen, and a guy can get injured, and I mean, look at what happened to Pete Sell. I don't think that was a good moment for anyone involved. So that's my problem with it. If he would have just stopped it, you would have been like, okay, fine. Perhaps it was an early stoppage. The guy kind of went limp for a second. You can make a case for it. But because he didn't really just jump in there, stop the fight, it seemed as though he second-guessed himself right away and was almost like, oh, wait, I didn't really do it. And, you know, of course, there are, you know, a million people watching on television. You can't really do that. That's the part that bothers me the most. Referee, you have tough job. You have tough decisions to make. You have a tough job. We all know this. Just make your decision and go with it. You can't second guess yourself in the heat of the moment, because that just makes everything look worse.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reminded of the phrase that I've usually heard used as a criticism of most people, which is usually right, always certain. But in the case of a referee, certainty is the most important thing. You need them to be certain 100% of the time, even if they're only right 98% of the time. And that's the biggest problem we've seen with Eve Levine, is he is not certain of himself. When is it time to stop a fight? When is it not time to stop a fight? And that's very disappointing. And I agree with you. Great UFC 98 show. All the televised fights were exciting, I thought, really. And then the three that didn't make the TV broadcast, I ended up watching on UFC.com. And I just thought it was a terrific show all around. Maybe the very first fight, Kaplan against Roop, wasn't the most exciting I've ever seen. But, you know, all around, it was a very good UFC 98 show. And I think that the UFC just has a ton of momentum heading into the summer with a lot more big fights coming up.
Yeah, and Kaplan Roop, not that exciting, but anytime Kaplan fights, I'm always very excited just to see what his entrance is like. And I mean, the guy's wearing the old school wrestling tights. How can you not like Dave Kaplan? I hope he sticks around in the UFC for a long time. But you're right. I cannot wait for the summer, as we talked about last year. This kind of, you know, was the kickoff event. And UFC 99, we haven't spoke since then with Mirko Krokop being on the card, and now Cain Velasquez against Czech Congo. That's now turned into a great card. And by the way, I spoke to someone at the UFC this week. You and I talked, you know, sort of off the record, I guess you can call it, or, you know, what is it? Not off camera, off microphone? What do you call it when you talk?
Off air, bro?
Off air, there you go. Okay. Yes, off air. And someone told me that there are going to be six fights going into that pay-per-view card. So
That's exciting. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that's a really exciting thing, especially when there's no title fight. So every fight is three rounds. If they do go through with that and give the fans six live fights, I think it says a lot about the quality of the product in the UFC that this UFC 99 card, it has six fights that I'm really excited about.
Yeah, very excited. I mean, I was really nervous that Fisher Uno was going to get dropped, just because I didn't see them dropping Swick Saunders, and the rest of the fights made a lot of sense to be on the pay-per-view card. But now six fights going into the pay-per-view, and I love those 3 o'clock UFC shows. They're great. 3 o'clock Eastern time, of course.
Yeah, you know, Ariel, I love those too, and sometimes fans complain, and sometimes some fans say, well, I'd rather it be tape delayed on Spike than during the day on pay-per-view. I think it's great on a Saturday afternoon. There's no better way to spend a Saturday afternoon than watching a UFC fight. Obviously, I understand for there are some fans who really feel like the amount of money they're shelling out over the course of a year is just too much. I certainly understand from that standpoint, but I agree with you. I think it is a great way to spend a Saturday afternoon to watch one of those pay-per-views in Europe.
Yeah, I do like it better in the winter because, you know, like one of those January pay-per-view cards in England is a lot more fun than a Saturday afternoon in the summer, but I'm not going to complain. I like it. I actually like it a lot better. And, you know, it's in the summer, you could still go out afterwards, so no problem about that. But I will say that with that card and then the day before with this Strikeforce card now finally, you know, coming together with this Brett Rogers-Andrei Arlovski fight, which, you know, we could talk about. It is an interesting time in MMA. And then you've got also WEC 41 the day after Strikeforce. UFC 99 is the next day. But we might as well get into Strikeforce right now if you don't mind.
But let me just clarify. UFC 99 is 1 week after Strikeforce. WEC 41 the day after Strikeforce, just so people can mark their calendars.
Yes, yes. That was kind of a weird way of going about it. Yes. June 6th, Strikeforce. June 7th, WEC. June 13th, UFC 99. That's the way it's going down come June. But Arlovski Rogers, I want to get your thoughts on this because I absolutely hate this fight. Obviously, on paper, it's sexy. Andrei Arlovski, big name, coming back after the Fyodor loss. Brett Rogers, undefeated, has looked great in Elite XC and in Strikeforce in his last fight this past April. But this doesn't make any sense for me in terms of building contenders in the heavyweight division. Now I view this as a clear way of killing Brett Rogers' momentum. I mean, here's a guy who was beating, you know, lower level talent, making his way up the ladder. All of a sudden, he runs into Andrei Arlovski, former UFC heavyweight champion. He's so far above him in the rankings and in terms of talent that, you know, look what happened to Roy Nelson in October. Nelson gets knocked out pretty badly, and now he's a total non-factor after being you know, a top 10 fighter in that heavyweight division. So I really don't like this fight. It's put together in like, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before the fight. Why not just keep the Feijão Hammond fight, build up Feijão, tell the story that he's a training partner of Anderson Silva. It's the fifth fight on the card. This one really doesn't make sense from Strikeforce point of view in terms of building for the future.
Yeah, you know, you and I have talked about this before, but to me, this is a classic case of a fight that is set up to make the loser look bad more than it's set up to make the winner look good. And one of the things that Joe Silva, the UFC matchmaker, is so smart about is after almost every big UFC fight, you end up thinking, wow, the guy who won that fight looked great. And too often with Strikeforce fights, we're seeing matchups where it's more like you're saying, boy, the guy who lost that really looked bad. I mean, that's what a lot of people, for instance, were saying about the Shamrock-Diaz fight, that, wow, Shamrock really looked bad. I think it's going to work out the same way between Rogers and Arlovski. I expect Arlovski to win and to make everybody say, well, you know, Brett Rogers, the hype around him, he was just overhyped. He was never going to be any good. But even if Rogers pulls the upset, then what I think we're going to hear a lot of people say is, well, Arlovski cares more about boxing than he does about MMA, and Arlovski getting knocked cold by Fedor really changed Arlovski as a fighter. And I just feel like either way, this is not a fight that we're going to come out of this thinking, boy, the guy who won that, seeing him maybe take on Alistair Overeem is going to be an awesome fight for Strikeforce. Instead, we're going to come out of it thinking, eh, the guy who lost that either Arlovski or Rogers didn't look all that good.
The Arlovski situation is made so much more confusing in my mind just because we don't even know what his status is with Affliction and Strikeforce. If this is a one-and-done fight, if he only signed a one-fight contract with Strikeforce, then it makes absolutely no sense to me because what you're bringing in this guy to be, you know, one of your rising stars and the entire promotion. I mean, how many rising stars does Strikeforce have? They could have had one in Feijão. He was fighting for the title, and now all of a sudden he's not good enough to even fight on the card. I mean, that's crazy if you ask me. I'm a big Brett Rogers fan. I think he's got a, you know, obviously a good look. He's good on the mic. He's charismatic. You know, the way he called out Kimbo, a lot of people got behind him. Arlovski is Andrei Arlovski. why, you know, like, we don't even know what's coming up in August. Why not save Arlovsky if you are going to have Arlovsky be a part of your company? And clearly, I don't think he's going to be fighting for Affliction because he's taking this fight, or, you know, but who the heck knows? Why not save him for, like, a main event fight for August? Arlovsky or Overeem right off the bat makes a lot more sense than Arlovsky Rogers. It just, to me, it boggles the mind. And, you know, I'm a little disappointed with these sort of hotshot matches that they've been putting together, you know, with the catch weights and everything. I mean, if you look at that card, I think the card, one of the fights on that card that makes the most sense, believe it or not, Joe Riggs, Phil Baroni. Here are two guys stuck in sort of mid-level status at welterweight. One is going to rise up. One's going to fall down. They talk a lot of trash. They don't like each other, et cetera, et cetera. That fight makes sense. The rest, off the top of my head, they're just kind of thrown together. I mean, Jake Shields, why isn't he fighting in the welterweight division? Robbie Lawler, why isn't he fighting other middleweight contenders? Nick Diaz, I would have much rather seen him fight Jay Haran. Apparently, according to Haran's camp, Diaz turned down the fight. A lot of interesting decisions. And then on top of it, when are we going to see Gina Carano? You obviously spoke to her last week. It seems as though it's finally going to happen. But is it going to happen? When is it going to happen? It's time. They need that fight. They should have her main event. She's the biggest star on the roster, in my opinion, right now. And I think she would help them, you know, get some more momentum, because right now they're great fights on paper, but I like to see them build for the future, because I want to see Strikeforce succeed. I want to see them be a number two competitor to Zuffa, UFC/WEC, and I just don't see them building for the future right now.
Yeah, and one other point to make, and you and I have both hammered them for this before, and you and I are in agreement that we want to see Strikeforce succeed. We're not setting out to knock Strikeforce, but I don't like either of these catchweight bouts coming up, Lawler, Shields, Diaz, Smith, at catchweights that are close to middleweight. And the one of the things I really dislike, I don't like catchweight fights anyway, but what I especially dislike is in both of these cases, We're not gonna see the winner fight for the middleweight title, because Kung Lee, the middleweight champion, is off pursuing his acting career. So even if Lawler or Shields or Diaz or Smith looks really impressive at those fights in the 180-pound range, it's not gonna mean anything in the title picture, because none of those guys are gonna fight the title holder, because the title holder isn't fighting right now. It boggles the mind. You and I are definitely in agreement about that.
Yeah, great point. And let's just forget about, like, UFC, WC, because, you know, like, to me, I just want to see great fights. Isn't it funny that we're talking about, you know, the issues the UFC might be having if GSP defeats Thiago Alves at UFC 100? And now here we have Jake Shields, a great contender, a guy who, in my opinion, top three, top four, top two, whatever you want to call him. That would have been a fight that I would have loved to see, Jake Shields fight GSP after this fight. And here he is fighting, you know, catchweight against Robbie Lawler, a fight that I see not really helping out either fighter. So that's just unfortunate. You don't really have those situations come up a lot in MMA. I think as MMA fans, we can't really complain all that much. We see a lot of our dream matches come to fruition as opposed to, you know, in boxing. But I would have loved to see Jake Shields fight a GSP sometime in the future. I do hope also, one more note on Strikeforce, that I do hope that they announce their August card at this show or before this show, because you have to keep the momentum. You have to have the fans tuning in, knowing when the next fight is, and start to get in a bit of a rhythm, because you're going from April to June. You know, the Challengers card is not really built up as much. So I hope that they have their ducks in a row for the next card. And I hope that they start building for the future, because they have some really good pieces. And, you know, lightweight champion Josh Thompson, he comes back healthy. You got a great fight against Melendez coming out. Hopefully Overeem gets healthy. But it just seems as though, for whatever reason, since this purchase of the Elite XC contracts, the momentum and the excitement that everyone thought about when we were thinking about these dream matches, just for me, has kind of fizzled a little bit.
Yeah, and just one more thing, and I don't want us to beat a dead horse on this, but you mentioned Fizhou. Why in the world isn't Fizhou in the main event of a Challengers series fight? If he's not good enough to make the televised card of one of these main Strikeforce shows, the main event of a Challenger Series fight would just be the perfect place for him. Instead, we've got Joey Villaseñor, who is not young and up and coming. He's in his 30s, and he has more than 30 pro fights on his record. He's in the Challenger Series. That doesn't make any sense to me either. A lot of this doesn't make any sense to me.
Yes, and like you said, I mean, I feel like we've beaten this dead horse enough. It's like asking us, it's coming back to life and asking us to stop. So I agree 100%. Putting him on an untelevised card fight when we know Showtime never shows those fights makes absolutely no sense. But let's talk about Dream, which, you know, while we're on the topic of things making no sense, Jose Canseco making his MMA debut. Were you as happy with his performance as I was?
And
I was
yes, it was a fascinating performance by Jose Canseco. To his credit, he did land the first strike of the fight. He didn't just completely run away, although he very quickly realized that he wanted no part at all of Hongman Choi. And, you know, Hongman Choi, he's been punched and kicked by world-class K-1 kickboxers. He doesn't really care if Jose Canseco lands a couple of strikes against him. Silly, ridiculous, car crash that you can't look away from type fight. Obviously, we knew Hongman Choi was going to win. I guess 118 of round one was the official time. And if we had had an over-under, that's probably right around where we would have had it. You certainly can't glean much from that. But that's, you know, the fans in Japan, they've started this Super Hulk tournament, and the fans in Japan seem to like stuff like this.
I didn't see anyone booing. I mean, those four fights were some of the weirdest MMA bouts I've ever seen, and everyone seemed to be very happy. And then they kind of made up for it with the other fights. The thing about those Japanese cards and the Dream cards on HDNet, they're just so long, and when it's so early in the morning, I just wanted to speed up. You know, like there's just so much fluff there. I love the entrances, of course. But it just seems to drag so much, and I sort of I've learned my lesson. I woke up an hour and a half into the telecast, so then I could fast forward through all the stuff, and then kind of come up to speed once the normal fights were televised live. So I think I had a pretty good plan. I give you a lot of credit for waking up at, I guess, what was it, 4 a.m. your time?
4:30? It was indeed 4 a.m. my time, Ariel.
Jeez, that is, you deserve some kind of medal for that, because to wake up that early to watch, you know, the likes of Bob Sapp and Jose Canseco and Hongman Choi is a true testament to the kind of MMA fan that you are. But overall, I mean, you know, the Super Hulk tournament, if it ends up being Musashi against Sokoju, then you kind of, at the end of the day, you'll forget that all this even happened. And that's a sort of intriguing fight, just because Musashi 185er coming up. Can Sokoju, you know, reclaim some of the magic that he had in Japan? So that, I'm fine with that bout. So, you know, it was ridiculous. It didn't last very long. It was kind of funny at times, and that's it. I don't think MMA fans should, you know, go too crazy over something like this.
Yeah, I think you and I have basically the same attitude. I will say that if you're going to be impressed by anything in this Super Hulk tournament, certainly by far the most impressive was Musashi beating Mark Hunt in a minute 20, because Mark Hunt is he's a legitimate fighter who he doesn't have a great record, but he's fought really good opponents, and he's got experience as a K-1 kickboxer in addition to experience fighting MMA. He was well known in the Pride organization. So I thought Hunt would put up a little bit more of a fight against Musashi than he did. So I guess I certainly went into the Super Hulk tournament thinking that Musashi was the favorite to win it, and nothing I saw this morning changed my mind about that.
So what did you think of some of the other fights? Obviously, the show kind of ended on an anticlimactic note with the Mayhem Miller fight. Do you think that he deserves like these two guys should fight? Because according to Miller's Twitter, they've held up the belt, and they are going to fight sometime in the future.
Yeah, I guess they're going to do it a third time. They did, of course, do it last year as well with Jacare beating Mayhem Miller. Then they had this rematch that ends with a no contest. I'm not totally clear on why it's a no contest. To me, it looked like it should have been a disqualification. I didn't see Mayhem Miller's Twitter. Maybe he's explained it there or somewhere else I didn't see. It looks to me, though, like Mayhem Miller landed an illegal blow that opened a cut that prevented Jacare from continuing to fight. To me, that should be a disqualification.
I agree. That's why I thought it was a little surprising that they're going to give him another shot right away. You have to feel bad for any fighter from North America to come all the way to Japan and have the fight end like that. I can't even imagine what goes through their mind. That must be devastating. And on the flip side, you have Jose Canseco coming all the way from North America to pick up probably what is a pretty good check for, you know, over 60 seconds of work. How much do you actually think he got paid for that? Do you think he got actually like a pretty good amount of money?
I would assume he did. I mean, I would, you know, I don't think we're talking good money compared to what he used to make as a baseball player. But, you know, I would assume that for very minimal training and for a couple days in Japan at the press conference and the fight, I mean, you know, I figure he made a pretty significant chunk of change, don't you?
Like, what do you think? Do you think like over 50,000?
I do. I was going to say closer to 100,000.
Oh, really? Wow. That's actually great.
And that's not based on any type of inside knowledge. Right. That's just what I would guess a name like him might be able to bring in.
So it's possible that he might have been one of the highest paid fighters on that card.
I think that's very possible, yes, just because, you know, the name value. I mean, just to give you an example, Ariel, the Associated Press had a preview and a recap of Jose Canseco's fight against Hongman Choi. They never do that for MMA. So, you know, if they want a little bit of, if Dream wants, and if HDNet, their American TV partner, wants a little bit of mainstream publicity, Jose Canseco is the one guy on that card who can deliver it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was watching SportsCenter after the Canseco fight, and which just sounds weird to say, the Canseco fight. Still saying,
yes, it does.
But SportsCenter is live now in the morning, and maybe 30 minutes afterwards, they had highlights. They never actually mentioned Dream, but there was an HDNet credit at the top, so I guess they have to be happy about that. But not a great day for MMA, obviously, when you have Jose Canseco come in and fight, because it just makes it seem like sort of a freak show like in the early days. But thankfully, he didn't wear the tattoo shirt, so I was happy about that. One interesting part about the card, though, or probably the most interesting part, was the Yamamoto upset. I know, obviously, you know, you wrote a recap about it on Fan House, but this, I mean, I will say that I don't agree with Guy Mesker when he compared it to Buster Douglas beating Mike Tyson. I think that is a huge...
Yeah, that would be a slight exaggeration.
Yeah, a huge exaggeration. But definitely a huge upset for a guy with only, you know, one fight going into this fight, beating a guy who, you know, 17-1, people considered top pound for pound for a while before he was out with an injury. So that to me is really the highlight of this card. And now Joe Warren all of a sudden is sort of a star in MMA. You know, I know not everyone watches Dream here in North America, but that's a huge, huge victory to have on your resume for a young fighter.
Oh, it absolutely is. And, you know, Joe Warren has an outstanding amateur wrestling pedigree. So this guy's a legitimate athlete, needs to work on his stand-up. But I was very impressed that when Yamamoto was landing strikes, and Yamamoto always does, he's an outstanding stand-up fighter, Warren, he wasn't backing down. I mean, he was wincing a couple of times because, you know, Kid Yamamoto hits as hard as anyone in that weight class. But Warren, he stood his ground, and every chance he got, he would clinch, take the fight to the ground, which tells you that he had a good game plan going in. He's training with guys like Dan Henderson, Dan Henderson, it doesn't get much better if you're an Olympic caliber wrestler who want someone to teach you how to be a good MMA fighter. There's not a much better coach than Dan Henderson. I'm pretty excited about what Joe Warren could do. I don't know, to be honest with you, I don't have a clue who the favorite now is in this Dream featherweight tournament, but I'm excited about seeing what Joe Warren does.
I remember writing about it going into the first round of the tournament, and I called it the Kid Yamamoto Invitational, because he got a first round bye. It just seemed as though everything was being set up for him to, you know, have an easy walk to the title. And now, I mean, I wonder what they're thinking over in Japan, because as you know, you know, Dream is suffering on television there. That's one of the main reasons why Jose Canseco is being booked on their card and Bob Sapp and all these freak show fights. And for Kid Yamamoto to fall in the first round, I don't see the Japanese fans, even though this is a huge upset and they like that kind of thing, I don't see them, you know, taking to Joe Warren like he's like, you know, the next big thing over there. So this has got to be pretty devastating for Dream in terms of, you know, their television ratings for that, for the next card in July and then in September.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. You know, Dream really wanted Kid Yamamoto and Shinya Aoki to be the guys who were kicking the Dream banner, and it turned out neither one of these advanced even into the semifinals. They've got the featherweight tournament and the welterweight tournament. They certainly wanted Kid Yamamoto and Shinya Aoki to advance through those tournaments. Neither one of them even made the semifinals. That is a big disappointment for Dream. But one thing that is never disappointing to me, Ariel, is discussing MMA with you. It has been an outstanding hour of conversation. I hope you enjoyed it, Ariel. I hope everyone listening at home enjoyed it as well. And with that, we are over.